And Grammy Goes to Western PA after this call. You'll be able to find that on our websites shortly after the call is done. So today's call is focused on health policy. We're joined by Ann Torregrossa, who is the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Health Funders Collaborative, and Anne Marie Healy, who's Executive Director of the First Hospital Foundation. And they're going to talk to us today about current activities and priorities of the Pennsylvania Health Funders Collaborative. Anne Marie is also going to share some information about First Hospital Foundation's recent strategic planning process, in which she and her board arrived at a new focus that puts policy advocacy at the forefront of their work. So thanks to you both for being with us today. We appreciate your time. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Anne, and ask you to tell us a little bit about the Pennsylvania Health Funders Collaborative. Anne, you're going to want to hit *7 to unmute. Are you with us, Anne? I think you are on mute. So if you said something, can you start over?
Can you hear me now?
Yep, can hear you.
Okay. Great, wonderful. Thank you so much for having us on your call. We're delighted to share what the Pennsylvania Health Funders Collaborative has been doing. We just had our 10th anniversary. We started in 2007 under the leadership of Karen Feinstein of the Jewish Healthcare Foundation, and Russell Johnson, now of the HealthSpark Foundation. And they really were the leaders that convened the health funders and have, for our whole 10 years, been the co-conveners. The health funders are staffed by wonderful Robert Ferguson, who I hope is on this call. Couldn't do it without him and myself. We are a nonpartisan group association of about 40 to 45 health foundations. Many of them are conversion foundations, and they have a small service area. And we're pretty much throughout the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. The reason that the health funders got together was, one, they wanted to find a way to find out information about state policy that was affecting their grantees and the vulnerable populations that they served. They also wanted to see if there were policy issues that were affecting a number of communities that they could work on together. They thought that as a statewide philanthropic voice, that they would have much more impact advocating for policies to improve health for vulnerable populations than they would have on their own. And they also wanted the opportunity to perhaps find areas to collaborate as far as funding. Sometimes it would be difficult for a health foundation to get their board of directors to agree to have the foundation advocate for a certain policy. You might have Republicans and Democrats on the board. And if you could have an association or the Health Funders Collaborative do that, that's often much easier for executive directors. So our foundations have all kinds of grantees coming, pitching grants to them. What the collaborative allows is to help us build knowledge of current developments and figure out what's hot, what's important, what aligns with perhaps what the state is doing or other entities are doing. So it makes our grant making much more effective. As I said, we can also figure out if we're funding the same things and perhaps join together and do joint funding for something that maybe we could not individually have been able to take on. And we also leverage each other's expertise and resources so that we can have a greater impact. Generally, we always have an annual meeting, usually in the fall. This year, we put it off until after the election. And it was a good thing we did because the election was such a surprise and all the planning we would have done pre-election would have been moot. We have quarterly webinars where our action groups report out on what they're doing, where we update them on what's going on, and we can realign our priorities going forward for the quarter. And we have our action groups that we'll be talking about a little bit in a few moments. Are there any questions on kind of the general organizational collaborative? Obviously, we don't want to put any of our foundations 501c3s in jeopardy, so, you know, we don't lobby to support specific legislation, but we do try to partner with Pennsylvania governors on Republican and Democratic on initiatives that we jointly agree on. Jenny, questions?
I haven't received any questions in the type-in field. If anybody has anything, please feel free to raise your hand. Or you can just unmute by hitting star 7. It looks like not, Anne. So if you guys want to go ahead and talk about the action groups and the work of the action groups a little bit.
Sure. We have several action groups. They meet monthly, sometimes bimonthly. They include the following: enrollment and exchange, healthy eating, healthy living, or our HEAL work group, integrated behavioral health, and long-term services and supports. Anne Marie has just taken over chairmanship of the enrollment and exchange group, and asked her to kind of run through some of the activities that we've done, and are obviously becoming very important given all of the talk about repeal or of the ACA, Medicaid block grants, or per capita. It's probably our hottest action group right now.
Thanks, Anne. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. So as Anne just mentioned, I am actually the new leader of the Enrollment and Exchange Action Group. Actually, Frances Sheehan, formerly of the Brandywine Health Foundation, was the lead, and I very happily took over that. So the group was, as Anne explained just briefly, was developed by a group of foundations that were interested in health insurance issues, and that we were supporting education and enrollment efforts in our local communities. And some of the most recent focuses have been on enrollment in the ACA and the Medicaid exchange. Just want to go over briefly a few items that the enrollment and exchange group has addressed and worked on in collaboration, you know, as part of the larger PHFC organization. So in 2013, we commissioned a report by the Pennsylvania Economy League that produced a study analyzing the economic and fiscal impact of Medicaid expansion in Pennsylvania, which seems like a lifetime ago, but it did show that expanding Medicaid to low-income Pennsylvanians as part of the ACA would increase economic activity in the state and result in fiscal state savings despite state cost increases over time. We also monitored at the local and state level issues around health insurance enrollment in collaboration with the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, which is focused on community voice and community engagement. We also informed the state about health insurance enrollment issues, such as erroneous denials of Medicaid applications. We also analyzed the impact of marketplace enrollment in Pennsylvania. And we created a contingency campaign to educate policymakers about the need for a state exchange in the event that the Supreme Court ruled in favor of King in King versus Burwell case. All of this seems like a lifetime ago to me. And we also asked the Pennsylvania State Insurance Commissioner to create a chart to compare the health insurance benefits across the different plan options that were being considered for the state's essential health benefits package, which the insurance commissioner followed through on, and which allowed for meaningful public comment, which was great. We monitored the transition from Governor Corbett's privatized version of Medicaid expansion to Governor Wolf's full adoption of Medicaid expansion. And this was a policy decision that the Health Funders Collaborative helped to inform by previously commissioning that fiscal analysis of Medicaid expansion, which I mentioned previously. And in 2016, which was just last year, we began a discussion with the state insurance commissioner about the need for better consumer education around health insurance plan coverage and pricing. And as a result of these discussions, Anne, as the executive director for the Health Funders Collaborative, is now the chair of the Health Literacy Work Group. And that group is preparing a state plan to improve health insurance literacy, and the health commissioner had asked Anne to chair that working group. And then finally, earlier this month, the Pennsylvania Health Funders Collaborative released a data report on the impact to Pennsylvania of repealing the Affordable Care Act, which Anne will explain further as to what that data was about. But as you can see, this group, with the support of Anne and others, has played a key role in state policy issues and served as a partner to key state officials. And as Anne also just said, these issues are certainly really important, and, you know, it's important for all of us to focus on enrollment and protecting the ACA in whatever capacity we possibly can. So with that, I will hand it over to Anne.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. We have always taken the position that an important role of the health funders is to provide nonpartisan data to the public and to Congress or the General Assembly so that before they made any decision, they would have facts on what the impact of that decision would be. And so when Governor Corbett said that Pennsylvania couldn't afford Medicaid expansion, as Anne-Marie said, we commissioned a report by the Pennsylvania Economy League, which is generally a very conservative group, to see what the facts were. And we were committed to publishing that report no matter which way it came out. If it came out that it was going to cost an arm and a leg, we thought the legislators should know that. And to the Pennsylvania Economy League's surprise, it came out the other way, that the jobs created by all the federal money coming in would produce revenue through income tax and sales tax that would more than pay for the state costs of Medicaid expansion. Right now, we're facing the potential repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. And so, again, we thought that it was critical to look at exactly who was being impacted by the Affordable Care Act. And what we found was that about 9 million Pennsylvanians who have private insurance, either through their employer or through private purchase, would lose some really critical insurance reforms, like no annual and lifetime limits, potential elimination of coverage for pre-existing conditions, the ability to keep your kids on your policy until age 26, no increased premiums for gender or medical condition, mental health parity, the no-cost preventative health care. So lots and lots of people who have taken advantage of these reforms will be impacted if the ACA is repealed. We generally think that it won't affect Medicare recipients. But one thing that the Affordable Care Act did was to gradually begin to close the donut hole. That is the amount of prescription drugs that Medicare would not pay anything for at all. And the Affordable Care Act was gradually closing that to eliminate it by 2020. And we found that about 2.5 million Medicare recipients who are now protected from large prescription drug costs, savings about $1,053 a year, will lose that protection if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. Similarly, we've got about 321,000 people who are getting premium assistance through the marketplace, who probably could not afford to purchase health care without that assistance, and another 700,000 who are getting health care coverage through Medicaid expansion. So over 1 million people who will lose their health care coverage if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. studies have shown that an estimated 137,000 jobs will be lost if the act is repealed. Our hospitals, of course, had many more people with health care coverage, and they saw a net patient hospital revenue gain of $2.7 billion. So hospitals will be negatively impacted if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. So we have analyzed this data, looking at it from the 18 congressional districts, looking at it through a number of counties, and tried to just put it out there for what it is, the facts of the impact of the Affordable Care Act on Pennsylvania. Another group that has been very active is our HEAL group, Healthy Eating, Active Living. We sent a list of suggestions to the governor when he was elected before he took office, and a number of those things have been adopted. We suggested that we eliminate the resource test or asset test for SNAP or food stamps, and this was done. We made suggestions on how to improve WIC services, and this was done. We suggested to the governor that he create a council of all of the agencies that have anything to do with food in his administration, so that they could coordinate and maximize those resources as much as possible. And the governor, in fact, did that. And he invited our many of our members to be on an advisory committee to work on a blueprint to eliminate hunger in Pennsylvania. And that blueprint recently came out. We've had a number of convening of food funders. The first one was in Philadelphia. I think it was probably the first time food funders came together. That was followed up by another meeting in Pittsburgh where everyone got an opportunity to see what Western Pennsylvania was doing as far as trying to deal with nutrition and hunger issues. And we're now planning a meeting in the center of the state, again, for all food funders in Pennsylvania. So our major emphasis right now for the healthy eating, healthy living is it raised joint funding to do a pilot for the Center for Science in the Public Interest to look at how we could use incentives to have SNAP recipients use their benefits to obtain, to buy more nutritious food. We're trying to push for implementation of the state's blueprint for hunger-free Pennsylvania. And as I said, we're planning a food funders meeting in the middle of the state soon. Our third action group is of behavioral health integration. It's the longest standing action group that we have. It was one of the reasons that the health funders got together, was a concern that physical and behavioral health were so separated and needed to be integrated to benefit patients. Excuse me. One of the things that we've been doing is working with Pennsylvania's Medicaid program, which is, as you know, very bifurcated as far as physical and behavioral health, and suggesting how they may use reimbursement methodology to really encourage and force integration and use evidence-based models of care so that we have a much more integrated delivery of services. We've created a policy brief on how states have transitioned from a carve-out where behavioral health is separately funded and delivered to a carve-in Medicaid system for behavioral health benefits. And we've been meeting with medical director for medical assistance programs and the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse on ways that we can partner together to try to have better integrated care under the Pennsylvania Medical Assistance Program. One thing they've asked us to look at is how we can work to get a common consent form that would allow providers to share physical, behavioral, and substance abuse information. Can we work together to help fund a regional data-driven learning collaborative to spread best practice for physical and behavioral health providers? I've had a number of primary care doctors say that when they have a patient who has a cardiology issue, they'll refer them to the cardiologist, they'll pick up the phone, call the cardiologist, talk with them about the patient and know what's going on. If they have a Medicaid patient with a behavioral health need, only thing they know is the 800 number on the back of their medical assistance card. There's no collaboration whatsoever. They don't know who's prescribing what for behavioral health versus physical health. It is not an ideal system of care. So we've asked the Department of Human Services to identify the physical health and behavioral health providers by region who have a high number of Medicaid patients so that we can begin to try to get those two to even know who they are and begin to collaborate on care. The department has recently aggressively monitored prescriptions for adolescents, trying to reduce the amount of prescriptions that children having behavioral health issues are receiving. That's appropriate, but our concern is that they also put in place other behavioral health services in lieu of those prescriptions to help those adolescents and their families cope without the prescriptions. Also kids in foster care this is happening with. And we've pointed out to the department on several occasions billing difficulty, particularly the FQHCs have, federally qualified health centers, who have both physical and behavioral health integrated in their practice and inability to get reimbursement for behavioral health. So our emphasis right now is really looking at appropriate and effective behavioral health services for children and adolescents, and a workforce trained in evidence-based practices to work with those kids, looking at this regional data-driven learning collaborative to integrate both the physical and behavioral health providers who have a large number of Medicaid recipients, and then, of course, the opioid epidemic. What are strategies for trying to effectively address this? Finally, we have an action group, long-term services and supports for seniors and people with disabilities. This is our second hot topic action group. As you probably know, the Commonwealth is moving towards mandatory Medicaid managed care for long-term services and supports, and they will be requiring all dual eligibles and people in most waiver services to enroll in a managed long-term care service and support, MCO, HMO. So it is going to totally transform how long-term care services and supports are paid for and delivered in Pennsylvania. Before this, they were fee-for-service, and there was very little coordination. Now it's going to be run by these HMOs. There's been a huge amount of litigation with all kinds of bid challenges by the unsuccessful 11 bidders, by some of them. They're down now to three statewide groups that will be providing HMOs that will be providing this care. They finally got the green light to go ahead by the courts in January. And they're moving to start implementation in southwestern Pennsylvania January of next year, and then moving rapidly to statewide implementation. Health funders have been very involved in commenting on all of the policy papers the draft RFPs, the draft managed care state agreement or contract. We've testified at public hearings. We've really played a huge role in trying to make sure that this can be as good as it can be. In addition to doing this, we've played a substantial role in serving as neutral conveners for community stakeholders to come together and prepare for the rollout of Community Health Choices. The Jewish Healthcare Foundation, along with several other foundations in the Southwest, has really been a poster child for this. And they've gotten a huge number of providers and consumers to find out that this is coming down the pike and to learn about it and actively become involved with it. In the Southeast, HealthSpark Foundation, First Hospital, Independence Foundation have been convening meetings in their counties to try to advise consumers and healthcare providers that this is coming. Generally, we found them to be totally clueless and they had no idea this was coming down the pike. So really, these information sessions have been very important to getting people prepared for this very aggressive rollout. We're looking to set up regional advisory boards so that if, similarly to when Health Choices was initiated, if there are problems, they can come to the attention of the state and get quickly resolved because it is a big change in a very short period of time. And we do other general health advocacy as issues come up. One is community health workers, and there was a statewide convening on that and making recommendations on how they should be paid and what criteria there should be for any kind of certification. Obviously, when the state and federal budgets come out, we try to brief our members on that and identify any key issues that might affect vulnerable populations. The state re-procured the Health Choices RFP twice for physical health, and there was a bid challenge the first time ago. They rebid it and just recently announced successful bidders, and there's been another bid challenge, and so the courts have put that on hold. We've been involved with the state certified community behavioral health center planning process, the state substance use disorder health homes, centers of excellence, the Money Follows the Persons grant, and the Pennsylvania Achieving a Better Life Act for people living with disabilities. So right now, you know, we're all hands on deck with trying to hold on to what health care we have. There is an unprecedented threat to health care coverage for our most vulnerable people, both those in Medicaid expansion, those who receive coverage through the marketplace, but I think you've all heard talk about Medicaid block grants possible per capita, which would just be a disaster for Pennsylvania. If you look at Pennsylvania's spending for its Medicaid program, right now we're spending about 18% for children, 50% on people with disabilities, and 22% on the aged. So over 91% of our Medicaid spending is for our most vulnerable, children, disabled, and the aged. And if those funds are limited, it could be a very serious matter, particularly given the demographics of Pennsylvania, with our largest growing population, those age 85 and older. So we're in a real period of upheaval. We think it's terribly important that we get information, fact-based information out to people so that they understand the consequences and the importance of what's going on. And you know, hold on to your seats. That's all I can say.
Is there any, are there any questions for Ann? As a reminder, if you want to unmute by pressing star 7 to ask a question, you're welcome to at this time.
Ann, this is Anne Marie. Recently, the president of Independence Blue Cross issued a statement in support of the, I guess what we could call as the replacement of the ACA, specific aspects of it. Is there anything that foundations or a role for foundations can play in, I guess, one, understanding, you know, you talked about hospitals and what the perspective is on hospitals, but my understanding is that we haven't been able to really understand what the health plans are thinking about and what their approach is. I don't know if you have any insight or advice on that.
Well, obviously the Affordable Care Act, you know, could be better. There's no question that probably deductibles were too high. People did not understand how to use their insurance coverage. So there's room for improvement with the Affordable Care Act. The president has said that if it's going to be replaced, it's going to be replaced with something that's even better. And I think, you know, it's important that we as foundations who, you know, fund initiatives for vulnerable populations really advocate that be the case, that there should not be replacement, there should not be repeal without replacement, and that replacement has to be a viable one.
And this is Barb from Grantmakers. I'm imagining we have some funders on the call who are more generalists, who don't specialize in healthcare issues. And if I were one of those funders, say a community foundation, I would be wondering what are the two or three most important things that I should be communicating to my state and federal lawmakers if I have the ability, you know, if I have my board's sign off and I can share information with them and educate them. What are the, you know, would you focus on the impact of repealing the Affordable Care Act? Would you focus on, you know, the impact of Medicaid block grants? I mean, what are the two or three top things that foundations who don't specialize in this field can be reinforcing, the top two or three messages?
Number one, Jenny, I don't know if you sent the link out for the ACA data book that we prepared.
I did. Everyone received the report.
Okay. If you click on that, and it looks very thick and a little overwhelming, but you can find your congressional district or, in some cases, your county. And it, just in a very fact-based way, all based on government figures and academics, you know, it's not made-up stuff, it's not fake news, it lays out the impact that repeal of the Affordable Care Act would have on that congressional district or that county or our state. And I think if you can find the relevant one for your area, sharing that, sending it to your representative, you know, just want you to, you know, the Pennsylvania Health Funders has put this out. I want to make sure that you're aware of it, would be important. I don't think Congress people have any idea that repeal of the Affordable Care Act would touch virtually every single person in their district, be they having private insurance, whether they're on Medicare, whether they're on Medicaid or marketplace insurance. It's going to affect virtually every single person. I think the only ones that it will not affect are probably, you know, the undocumented immigrants. The other thing that I would urge you to do is, it's terribly important that Medicaid's funding look more, much more like it is now. The problem with block grants is that if you have a recession, if you have a large number of elderly people needing long-term services and supports, there's absolutely no way to adjust. And you're going to have elder people services fighting with disability services, fighting with children's services to get adequate funding for health care. And there was a certain genius in the way Medicaid funding happens. The federal-state ratio is adjusted according to what's going on in the economy of the state. It's a shared expense between the feds and the states. And I think what many of those in Congress would like to do is to give a block grant and have the states have to decide who they're going to cut off, what they're going to pay for, what services are going to be eliminated. So it looks like the Congress didn't do that to people. So, you know, I think really advocating for don't mess with our Medicaid is very important. The CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, ends unless it's reauthorized on September 30th of this year. So making sure that kids don't fall through the cracks is probably the third thing. So ACA, here's who it's helped. Don't replace it with anything that doesn't continue to provide that help. Sure, fix it, but don't eliminate it. Number two, keep Medicaid the way it is. And number three is we need CHIP to be reauthorized. I'm sure there are other people have other things they might want to suggest. Russ or Robert or Joni.
And this is Anne Marie. What I would add, just kind of expanding on the question, is that, you know, what I have found in my interactions with different types of foundations, meaning foundations that focus on education, foundations that focus on the arts, that these issues touch all of the populations that foundations that are focusing on a specific area, that those that will touch all of these people, that it's not just a siloed specific health issue, that it's really important that the voices that are speaking are from a diverse population, that it's not, you know, so I think that from my perspective, there's a role for all different types of foundations, whether it be community foundations, whether it be corporate foundations or private, public, whatever it may be. And I think, you know, it's an opportunity, you know, similar to all of the various rallies and et cetera that are happening and protests, you know, it's bringing foundation leaders and staff people together around something that's really important and will impact everyone. And I think that the Health Funders Collaborative has done a really great job over the years in doing that because, as Anne said, you know, one individual voice doesn't necessarily have the same impact as a group of 45 foundations. So just something to kind of add to what Anne was saying in more specific topics.
That's a really good point. I know the artist community in Philadelphia, almost a huge number of them are getting their coverage to the marketplace. And they're just petrified about how they're going to continue to have healthcare coverage. The other thing I would say is that, you know, I think if foundations in a region can collaborate and ask for a meeting with their congressional representative, you probably will find someone within your group, perhaps someone who's a member of the Pennsylvania Health Funders Collaborative, who, you know, can answer questions and feel more comfortable with the topic with legislative staff, and if not, you know, in some cases I could go with our members and others to talk with them. My experience has been that they are not very well informed. You don't have to have a lot of expertise. They're just generalists often. The staff members in the district offices are generalists, and they're not that sophisticated, and you don't have to understand the entire multi-page ACA to make your point.
Here, we just had a question come in from Philanthropy Network Greater Philadelphia. Are there areas where we think the state legislature might be most responsive to the interests of health funders, or are closer to having common ground?
Yeah, I think the state legislators, you know, are facing pension issues, unfunded, you know, big deficits of billions of dollars going forward, and the thought of changing how Medicaid is funding and putting it all in the state has got to absolutely rock them to the core. So I would think that educating our state legislators about the fact that they should be advocating to keep Medicaid funding the way it is would be very important, and that once they understood that, there would be common ground.
Am I unmuted still?
Nope. Yeah, just.
Okay, I couldn't tell. This is a little confusing how to, because I'm on my, never, it doesn't matter. So it seems like a lot of the questions are around what are the opportunities for other foundations, whether you're health funders or not. And I think those are good questions. And I wonder if that's something that people would like to reconvene about at another time to specifically talk about opportunities. I don't know who's on the call, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, if you guys, if anyone who would be interested in reconvening around that wants to just click hand raise and we can get a sense of numbers, that would be great. Thanks for raising it, Joni.
That would be great to have a, you know, a common letter just expressing, you know, concern about people that could be negatively impacted.
Or even if we could provide any kind of technical assistance.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Certainly.
That's a great idea, Joni. This is Barb with one more question about the state. I think most of everybody has read about the proposal to integrate the Department of Health together with DHS and sort of integrate human services, aging, drug and alcohol services, and other health care. For funders who don't specialize in health, you know, what do you think the impact of that integration will be on the nonprofits that everyone is funding? Are there, you know, the drive to do this seems to be mostly, you know, for potential cost savings at the state level administratively. Do you think that nonprofits are going to be affected, or how might they be affected, and how might funders help them through that transition?
We haven't received a lot of details about how this is to be organized. I think in the budget there is a organizational chart. I think probably there are several reasons for the governor doing this. One, as you said, is to save money. Two is to try to qualify for some federal funding that is available to states that are trying to restructure themselves to be more efficient and to be more responsive to consumers and entities that need state services. But, you know, it's scary, particularly in light of everything else that's getting changed. They haven't indicated who would be in charge of this mega agency. So, you know, you don't know if all four of the secretaries, I guess three, one resigned or was fired, are looking for other jobs. There certainly is room for improvement. I mean, when I was with the state, the Department of Public Welfare, I always wondered why it took so long for anything to happen in the Department of Public Welfare. It's a huge, messy bureaucracy. And so I think, you know, I think there is obviously room for improvement. There's also potential for, if it's being primarily driven by cost savings, a situation that would not be ideal. I think we have to really, you know, keep our eye on it. I would hope that they would have some kind of advisory group that is going to help them, if they get legislative approval to do this, make sure that the stated reasons for going forward are in fact realized.
Great, thanks, Ann. I think we had a couple more questions, but I wanted to shift focus just for a moment and take advantage of Anne Marie being on the call with us. We know that First Hospital Foundation recently shifted its strategy to focus on policy advocacy. Wanted to hear from her a little bit about the planning process that went into that and how you arrived at this new focus.
Sure. Thanks, Jenny. I'll be actually pretty brief. So as a health funder who's been in existence actually for 20 years and been supporting direct healthcare services for the majority of our existence, and then over the last 5 years, really shifting to addressing social determinants of health and addressing environmental issues, you know, focusing on supportive housing, violence prevention and support, benefit access, legal representation, youth development, et cetera, and at the same time really seeing a change in the service provision of organizations at the, you know, local and the national level. And as I said, you know, healthcare is changing. And about 3 years ago, due to term limits, my board was changing. So we were having new board members, and these were new people. And, of course, they were asking the typical questions of who are we, what's our role, what are we trying to accomplish, what's our impact. And as a result of that, it was the decision of the board, with my encouragement, that we engage in a strategic planning process to make sure that what we were focusing on with regard to our grant making, as well as any non-grant making activities, really did was being responsive to the needs of the community. So It took us a little longer than we thought. It took us about 3 years. But in that time period, we also, as a health conversion foundation or legacy foundation, had some legacy issues that we had to address, and in order for us to move forward as an organization. So having a new board and, you know, having a desire to be more focused in our grant making, we did actually make a few strategic decisions, which is focusing our funding priorities and moving from a responsive receiving applications approach to grant making to having staff-driven directive initiatives, and also reducing our geographic area, because in Philadelphia it's extremely, the need is extremely great. And then the final piece is really focusing on the policy and the systems issues related to health and social determinants of health. So, you know, why did we decide that policy and advocacy was important? You know, we feel that in order to improve outcomes, both at the service provider level and the individual level, we must also address the system, the policy, and the regulatory issues that dictate how services are provided and paid for, as well as the systems in which the organizations operate at the state and the local level. And I think, you know, the Health Funders Collaborative and Anne's presentation has really spoken to that. Fortunately for me, I, as my board was changing, we, the new board members had, have extensive experience in policy and advocacy, as well as I do. So we are experienced in walking that narrow line between advocacy and lobbying. So we know we can educate and advocate. And we know that as a private foundation, we cannot lobby. So we understand the opportunities and the challenges of policy and advocacy and supporting specific changes, and that we know that it's a long-term investment that we're going to have to make because we may not see results for a long time. And given this current environment, who knows what's going to happen. But we felt that it was an opportunity for us to play a neutral role. And actually, one of the focuses, one of our initiatives will actually be assisting with the rollout of community health choices in southeastern Pennsylvania and being that convener and being that partner to ensure that the rollout is successful, not, in southeastern Pennsylvania. And then from a grant-making perspective and also from a policy and advocacy perspective, it's important for us, and we feel it's beneficial for our grantees and community partners to be their voice because they can't always be at the table. So being able to represent their voice is really important to us. And then from a process perspective, the grant-making level, we are planning on investing in the organization as a whole and not necessarily on programs or a campaign, a one-off type of thing, that we want to provide these organizations with the tools, meaning funding and technical assistance, so that they have the ability to advocate and engage in policy work whenever needed, and they won't be using our dollars because, we can kind of do that little work around there. We have always felt, and now that I have this new board and, we now see the need to be an advocate and a voice on policy because we can fund all the direct services that we want. If we're not addressing these system and policy issues, we're just going to keep kind of spinning our wheels and keep asking the same questions over and over again. So, it's a great opportunity for us. We're also working on changing our name and making our name and our brand reflect our new mission and our vision. So there's a lot changing here, and we're really looking forward to the next couple years. The other thing that I wanted to real quickly address that Jenny and Amy had asked me to share, the one aspect of our strategic planning process is that last year, while we suspended our grant cycle, I became aware of the fact that six other foundations in Philadelphia that fund in Philadelphia were also engaged in a strategic planning process. And as I tend to do, my thoughts went to nonprofits and consumers and what happens to everyone if each of these foundations narrows its grant-making focus, reduces the number of grants, and changes funding priorities. So we were all engaged in this process individually and most likely would come out of it individually, launching our new approaches individually and never knowing what the collective impact might be. So I brought everybody together. Everyone was happy to meet and share and have a good time and everything. But what was striking about this is what came out of that first meeting is that, yes, indeed, we all were going to strategically narrow our issue areas that would create concerns for nonprofits. But at the same time, we would have some flexible pots of money to support innovation and any issues that may come up, and that there was a desire and a movement on all of our parts to focus on advocacy, policy, and the civic leadership roles that foundations can play, as well as a convening role. And the most important aspect of this conversations that we've had is the fact that we need to communicate our individual changes carefully, and that we need to try in some manner to do this in a in a coordinated manner, and we've actually developed a timeline when we're all going to roll out our strategic plans. We're talking about what our decisions, how they will impact organizations and what our unified message could be and how, you know, just to kind of ease the pain of all of this and host collective meetings with nonprofits, et cetera. But for me, and we will continue meeting because everyone is committed to, you know, minimizing the impact of all of these various changes. But for me, a big lesson for me was actually that working in a vacuum can have a great impact, but not necessarily a positive impact. So, and I think, you know, Pennsylvania Health Funders is an example of how, you know, individually working is important as a foundation, but collectively you can have a greater impact. So just wanted to kind of share those things. And, you know, we're into the next phase of our new life, and we're excited to partner with other funders too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Anne Marie. We have just about 1.5 minutes left here. If there are any questions, any final thoughts or questions, I'd like to give the opportunity once more for any last questions. You can press *7 to unmute your line. I think Joni and Robert, I think you might have had a few questions for Anne. If you just hit *7, it'll unmute.
Hello, this is Robert Ferguson. I just had a quick comment about the question around the potential impacts of consolidating the Departments of Human Services, Health, and Drug and Alcohol. And I think especially in the context of the opioid epidemic, there could be a lot of efficiencies that would be created through a consolidation that would have a potential positive impact on the nonprofits, because especially around coordinating the drug and alcohol funding when it's in a separate department, it creates a lot of administrative issues that could potentially be eased through consolidation.
That was the wonderful Robert Ferguson.
Thanks, Robert. I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up. We're at 3:00, so I want to be mindful of everybody's time here. Thanks so much to Anne and Anne-Marie for taking time to share your knowledge with us and your experience. I'm sure that I don't want to speak for you guys, but I'm certain that they will be happy to answer any questions or do any follow-up with anyone on the call who would like to. If you want to just shoot me an email, I'll be happy to connect you. You're going to receive a follow-up email from us with the link to the audio from this call, so you'll be able to revisit it or share it with anyone that you, any members of Grantmakers or Philanthropy Network that you think would find it valuable. And we're going to have a survey, too. And I just want to make a plea for you guys to respond to that, if you would, because it's very helpful to us as we continue to shape this series moving forward. We sincerely appreciate your input. And I want to ask you to save the date for the next call in the series, which is on Wednesday, March 29th, 2 to 3:30. It's a little bit longer. We have Abby Levine from Alliance for Justice, who will join us to cover some do's and don'ts of supporting advocacy. And don't forget to save the date for May 1st and 2nd for the in-person conference, the Pennsylvania Philanthropy Public Policy Conference in Harrisburg. So I'm going to stay on the line. Anyone who needs to click off, don't feel bad about doing so. We said we'd wrap up at 3, but if anyone wants to stay on and ask additional questions, I think we could probably stay for a couple minutes to do that. Let's see. Joni, did you have something to add? Let me see if I can get you unmuted here.
Can you
hear me?
I'm on my computer. I can't *7 anything, just so you know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if other people had that problem, but I have been having trouble. Anyway, my question really was quickly for Anne Marie, but I could talk to her offline if there's not time.
Then we still have a few folks on, so I think.
Are you on, Anne Marie?
Yeah, I'm on.
So, you know, we went through sort of a similar situation where we finally were getting out of that sort of general operating direct service grant making. And now what we're hearing from most of our grantees is that what they need in these times are operating funds and service funds. Have you been hearing that? And are you thinking at all about doing any more direct service?
Joni, what I didn't share was we actually have another grant initiative where we will be funding direct services. Part of that will be direct services. And what our approach is to our grant making is going to be that we're going to give the the organization funding. We're going to fund the organization and give them the funds that they need to provide X services to meet the goals that we're looking to meet. And then, and if an aspect of that is policy and advocacy, they can use that funding for that. So, we're looking at this as a grant-making strategy with policy as well as our human capital because, you know, Joni, you do know some of my board members who are quite policy-focused and those that are quietly doing it. So I, you know, organically have a board that also wants to be active participants in policy and advocacy work. So, I mean, we're meeting next week to talk about this in the current environment. So, you know, we are going to be funding both.
Thank you.
So we should talk about that, you know.
Yeah,
maybe
together. We should talk about mine. I want to pull my hair out.
Okay, don't pull your hair out.
Okay, well, not till I talk to you.
Okay.
Okay. We have one other question that came in. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I think that's it. So thank you guys again. Thank you to everyone who joined. And please do keep your eye out for follow-up email to this call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Please stand by.